he sort of did some mathematical representations of some of the theories and then realized that that didn't work properly. And so so he's kind of like rewriting it. But if, yeah, sort of gaining permission, if anyone's interested, it's a really good read, even though it's not finished. Just email me and I can send you a PDF of it. The one thing that is really good that I'm not very good at is he knows the history and the philosophy very, very well. So he goes through a very sort of in-depth account of what Mach's principle is, what he thinks Mach's principle is, and he gives quotes and examples, and then how, you know, sort of later in the book he sort of shows how his theory sort of claims to be a good representation of that. So if you're interested in that, that's definitely good. I put this up, kind of, it's just one of my good friends, because it's a lot of the theories I did yesterday and today are going to be in that. And if you want a bit more meat to dig your teeth into, the paper's there. Today I think I'm just going to start by reviewing what we did last time. Because the theory I'm going to talk about today is going to be very similar to the one that we did last time. The major difference, which is the key difference, is that the theory I talked about last week has an absolute time built right into the theory. Whereas this week, we're going to look at sort of a proposal that Hans talked about yesterday, which is not supposed to have any absolute time. So it'll be up to you to decide whether or not that's true or not. There's some issues. This is just a recall. We have a theory defined on, Newtonian theory is defined on a configuration space with particles with coordinates in three-dimensional space. And so what we did to this theory is we just added an extra variable that we called Q0. And it's a new dynamical variable in the theory, and it wound up being equivalent to Newtonian time. So equations of motion for the Q0 give something that's equivalent to Newtonian time. Now, the way that we did that is we started with just the Newtonian action, T minus V, and then we did a substitution that just took every occurrence of T, and we replaced it with d lambda times dq naught d lambda. And I changed T to q naught because I wanted to emphasize that it's now a configuration space variable. It's not sort of the canonical variable of the theory anymore. Okay. And so this is just the same thing as d lambda times q naught dot, where the dots are just derivatives. So we took this, we plugged that in, and then what we found was, we have an action. I don't really know if it's even worth writing down. It's not really worth writing down. But what we found was that now we have a theory that's reparameterization invariant. So if we take lambda and we substitute a new function of lambda, then it doesn't change the equations of motion, it doesn't change the theory. Basically, the theory doesn't depend on lambda. And a nice way to picture this is imagine we have our configuration space down here. This is the same configuration space. And then in this direction, we've got lambda. Right? So the solutions to the theory are just trajectories on configuration space. And here you have to specify initial position of all the particles and an initial time. And then here you have to specify the final position of all the particles and at a time, at a final time. Okay. Now, this thing on this little graph looks like this, right? But in general, what the lambda does is it just changes the parameterization of this particular trajectory. So a graph of that in this space might look like something that starts out here and then moves over here, all right? But if you substitute a new function for lambda, you might get something that starts out here at a different value of lambda, does something funky and ends at another different value of lambda. But the projection of this thing will always project down to the same trajectory in the configuration space, right? And it's sort of in this sense that you have an equivalence class of different possible trajectories in this configuration space crossed with lambda. So it's that set of equivalence. In that sense, this is a gauge theory. Now, Hans mentioned yesterday that this might not be a standard type of gauge theory. And you can see it's very different from, say, Yang-Mills gauge theory, where you've got equivalence classes are in a fiber bundle or something generated by a gauge group. This is very different from that. But still, in a certain sense, it's like a gauge theory. Mathematically, it can be treated that way. So how do we know? How do we see that gauge thing in the mathematics? Well, we found that there is a constraint in theory, but the momentum satisfied a constraint. And the constraint looks like the sum over I of the particle momentum squared over twice the mass plus p naught plus v is equal to zero. And this guy is canonically conjugate to this guy, but these guys are canonically conjugate to those guys. And so what we have is basically something that looks like on shell at least conservation of momentum. Conservation of energy. Because the p naught is like the negative. So that was good, and this constraint was telling us that that we have a gauge theory. It's a first class constraint because it's the only constraint in the theory, so it generates gauge transformations. The other thing we found was that the Hamiltonian, the canonical Hamiltonian, was identically equal to zero, and this turns out to be a generic feature of any theory that's root parameterization invariant that has this type of invariance. The Hamiltonian is exactly zero. But because of this constraint, the theory is not completely non-trivial, right? Because what we can do is we can add a Lagrange multiplier times the constraint to the theory, and then use this Hamiltonian to find our equations of motion. That works. And what we found was, if we do a variation with respect to these guys, we get Newton's laws. But in terms of where T is played by the role of Q naught, the Q naught is playing the role of T in the normal Newtonian theory. If we do a variation with respect to the Q naught, we got something that looked like conservation of energy, E equals T prime plus V, where the kinetic energy here is taken with respect to derivatives of Q naught, not of the lambda. And you can rearrange this, and it gave an equation that looked like the total time, which was the final time minus the initial time, is equal to an integral of t over e minus v. And this t now is just taken with derivatives of lambda, not of time. So what we found was that we actually had a relationship between the classical trajectory that we get as a solution to this theory and the amount of time that's elapsed. So the reason why I'm going through all this again is to remind you of the equations, because we're going to see very similar versions of the same equations this week. But also to remind you of the important conceptual points, which was the role that the energy played here. Okay, so in this theory, the energy was seen as an integration constant. It was, we specify these boundary conditions, And then we have our theory gives us a classical trajectory. And the E is set so that this is satisfied, right? So the E has to be, the E is basically a function of these boundary conditions. And that's very important because what it means is that E is basically dependent on the time that you impose on the theory. And that's why the theory has a background time at the end of the day. So that's enough of that. So today what we're going to do is we're going to quantize this, and it's not going to take very long. So we're going to quantize this guy. And then the next thing we're going to do is we're going to look at what I call Jacobi Barber Bertone. So let's do that. Any questions? That was just a review. And it was good because there's a couple people who weren't here last time. So the quantization. Is fairly straightforward. We had the fundamental Poisson brackets between the P's and the Q's. So to remind you of the notation, the I is the spatial index, and the small I is spatial, the big I is particle number. And what I want to do actually is put J here and J here, and then I've got delta functions. And these just get promoted to the p's and the q's, the phase space variables get promoted to operators that act on the wave function, and then the Poisson brackets get promoted to commutators. So we've got something like this, the hats on them, okay, but there's I here now. Which is really important, especially in the context of time. And we also have these guys also get promoted to operators. One. So this thing turns into at, not at, I. And this is actually kind of the crucial point, is that in this theory, time is a configuration space variable. It has a conjugate momentum. And when you promote that to an operator, this thing, which is supposed to be a constraint on the wave function, turns into the time-dependent trivial equation. For those of you not familiar with the Dirac procedure, when you have a gauge theory, you've got these operators and Poisson brackets defined on the full Hilbert space, which is defined on the configuration space. So the wave function is a function of the Q naughts and the Q i's particle positions. You have this constraint here that the momentum have to satisfy. So what that does is it restricts your system to live on some subsurface of the Hilbert space. So this guy is called the kinematical Hilbert space, and this guy is called the physical Hilbert space. And now your wave function is constrained to live on this surface. Okay. So this is a smaller Hilbert space than this guy. So when we impose this constraint, which now becomes an operator constraint on the wave function.
Okay. Yes. Are you taking a sort of strong constraint in the sense that h times psi must be zero, or just like the average of the expected value of h must be zero?
H psi is
a strong constraint.
It's a strong constraint.
Okay.
That's right. So it looks solid for it then. So h psi equals zero. Is the same thing as, you can see what happens. You promote these things to operators, and now operator P, if you pick a basis,
And it's actually customary to pick a basis where operator P is equal to minus I dot Q naught. And then Q operator Q is just multiplication by Q naught. So in this basis, you can see that you have time-dependent Schrödinger equation, right? And that's the thing that's not going to happen in the Jacobi theory. I wanted to make one more comment. Notice that the wave function on the physical Hilbert space is normalizable. It's just the same wave function we have in standard non-relativistic quantum mechanics. But you see, it's not clear to me that the wave function defined on the full Hilbert space is going to be. So we have this problem in quantum gravity. We'll say, well, can we define a normalizable wave function on full mathematical Hilbert space? And then expect that we have something that is normalizable as well. In this case, we have an example of a theory where we do exactly that, and all we do is we recover standard quantum mechanics. So, the fact that the wave function is not necessarily normalizable on the kinematical Hilbert space on which it's defined, right?
It is the opposite, right? So you start with the kinematical Hilbert space where you assume that that's the square integral wave function all on the extended configuration space.
Yeah.
And then what you find is that when you impose this constraint, those
fall. Well,
also here, the physical Hilbert space is surprisingly not even part of the kinematic Hilbert space. So that's what happens when you impose the constraints. It's sort of very...
It does weird things. But
yeah, so what happens is that you start with a kinematical Hilbert space, square integral wave function, so extended configuration space, and then you say, well, I have a constraint that should demand that h from psi is zero. Mm-hmm. But then you see that those solutions are not square integrable on extended configuration space.
Right.
So they don't even lie in that Hilbert space.
Yeah. That's right. But these guys, they're defined on this thing. So there's some interesting...
Yeah, so really what happens, you get kicked out of the original Hilbert space, you define, and you need to redefine in the product. So you have,
But anyways, the point is you get issues like this in quantum gravity as well. But here it's really not an issue, right? Because, at the end of the day, you think about it and you think all these weird things, but at the end of the day, you just have standard quantum theory. So there's got to be something right about what it's like. Those are some minor problems. So that was just a minor comment. Now let's get to the meat, which is actually what all of this results in preparing this for, which is this Jacobi-Barber-Bertoni theory. And the reason why I call it you'll see in a second why I call it that. So now we have a theory defined on, so let me just give you the picture here. So we start with configuration space, but not the extended configuration space we have here. Now it's just the cubes. The particle positions. So the idea is that if this is R3, you've got particles. All right, here, Q vector 1, Q vector 2, Q vector 3. And one of these configurations is just going to be a point over here. So, all right, so in general, our theory is defined on this, and we're looking for trajectories on this space. So as the system moves from here to here, these guys are moving around. Right? Now that's a picture that we're probably familiar with. But the thing that I want to emphasize is that is the basic assumptions of this theory. Okay? The theory assumes that we can put particles into R3, and that there's, at this point, there's meaning to the actual value of the coordinates here. But more than that, we also assume that we know where these particles are. and that the metric on this space is flat. But there's actually a lot of assumptions already built in just from this basic picture that might break down, that might need some modification in a better theory. So the basic reason is that here we know for certainty where each of the particles are. And when the system is moving through, basically what the theory is telling us is how these particles are going to be changing. And time is going to be a measure of that change. But in order for us to know how much time has gone by, we need to know where the particles are. But that's exactly the type of thing that kind of breaks down, very loosely speaking, in the quantum theory. We don't know for certainty where these particles are. And so trying to figure out how much they've changed over a certain amount of time is going to be difficult. And it's going to lead to, at the end of the day, again, very loosely speaking, that's just going to lead to the problem of time in this theory. So I got away with saying that. That's good. Well, let me talk about what this theory is. So what we assume is that we can define a metric on this configuration space. Okay? The metric is going to tell us basically the distance or the difference between two different configurations. So if I say that at this time I have this configuration, at some later point over here, I've got another configuration. What's the sort of distance between them, or what's the difference between the configurations? That's what this metric is going to tell us. Okay, and I'm going to call this thing capital G. Then once we have some idea of what this metric is going to be, we can write down the action. So the action for this theory is just an integral from the initial point in configuration space to the final point of the metric, which is going to be a function of the changes of configurations. And we take the square root so that it's a one form. Okay, so this is symbolic notation, right? And the reason why I'm keeping it symbolic at this stage is because this is meant to be a general statement. And we have some configuration space. In this case, we're talking about just particle positions. But it could be something much more general. For example, when we talk about general relativity, this configuration space will be the space of three geometries, or three metrics. Okay. And then we just define a metric. So some function is going to tell us the distance or the difference between these two configurations, a measure of how these two different configurations can be different from each other. And that will give us the action for this theory. Now, you can kind of see that the solutions of this are just going to be geodesics on the configuration space. So what we're looking for is we're looking for crossing trajectories that will have a minimum length in configuration space.
So what does the geodesic and the notion of minimal length have to do with connection? Are there any forces? Is there any dynamics to it?
Absolutely. I'll get to that in a second. Yeah. That's just a general comment right away. And then we'll look at how we define the metric is going to be the thing that how we interpret the different pieces of that metric is going to be how you get all the information about what the interpretation of the what the forces are, what the dynamics are. If there's another question? No. So that's exactly the point. I mean, right now it's a very general thing, but what we're going to assume is that the metric is a form like this, where you have minus b, which is just going to be a function of the coordinates, times some g prime thing. And this thing is the thing that's going to feed on the differences, the differentials. So this thing is good, is like a conformal factor of the metric, right? So V is defined as it's a quantity that's always smaller than zero or equal. smaller than zero, and it's the conformal factor. You can think of it as a conformal factor of a metric. The other thing, in our particle theory, this is going to be the potential. So we interpret the conformal factor of this metric as a potential of our theory. Right. So I'm going to motivate why we would think of the potential as that in a second, but for now that's how we interpret it. And so the leftover piece is going to be like the kinetic term. And depending on what the configuration space is, we get a different form for the kinetic term. So let's look at a specific example. And eventually this is just going to be general relativity, but for now, we're talking about particles. So let's look at specifically this guy. P dot is going to look like, for the particle model, it's going to be a factor of 4, which is just customary. So the potentials work out, right? Times the sum over I of half mi q dot squared. So it's just 4 times the thing that we normally call setting energies.
And the dot is with respect to lambda.
To lambda, arbitrary parameter. Yeah, that's right. Oh, maybe I should write. If we just stick in an arbitrary parameter lambda instead of these d's, this would look like an integral d lambda of minus v times g times q dot. So this is still kind of symbolic notation. So that's the point. We have a square root here of the potential and a square root of this piece, which is interpreted as the kinetic term. So in the particle model, that g is just 4t. And then the potential is just the normal potential. But it's really nice because energy plays such an important role. Right, to pull the energy out of the potential. So, I mean, in general, this is going to be some constant term, possibly plus other stuff. And what we're going to do is we're going to call the other stuff V, and then we're going to call E negative V naught. Right. So now, the action for the particle model. The JVB action is going to be equal to d lambda times 2 times the square root of t times d minus v. So this is the theory that we have for the case of particles. Okay. Now the J is because the first person to write this down was Jacobi. He wrote down this action. And it turns out that it's equivalent to Newtonian mechanics, and we'll see that in a second. But we studied it for other reasons. Now, the PV comes from when Barber and Bertotti looked at something. They wrote something almost identical to this down. They didn't know anything about Jacobi and the sort of like army of people that have been working on this theory for like almost 100 years. And they said, oh, this is a temporally relational theory for these reasons. So I like to call it JVB because it's Jacobi's theory, but with the interpretation as a timeless theory. You interpret the theory as something where time emerges as this it just time emerges from it.
It's a lambda, yeah. It looks like it's lambda. It's
yeah.
If you compare like internal dynamics, you have an empirical temperature scale.
Okay.
And you can derive absolute temperature scale, but you can write all your equation in respect of any, it can be completely crazy temperature scale.
Yeah.
So here you have anyway a one dimensional parameter. So that's your time. It's
that's
just your
it's like the time, but you can write, I can write this action with a little lambda as well, right? Because I have a t here, and the t has derivatives with respect to lambda. So I can write this action just in terms of dq's, right? And then it would look, it wouldn't look like you have this sort of time in there. And that's sort of the point. But there is a sense where the lambda is playing a sort of a crucial role because it's parameterizing this one-dimensional line, which is seen as a possible solution to the theory. So the lambda is there, but I don't really have to write it down. But it's, you know, it's something, right? So the d's are basically just the incremental sort of length here at a particular point.
So going to that, so this one problematic thing, if one say that lambda is just like a, you know, crazy clock, it doesn't, you know, always tick uniformly and so on. If you make that assumption that it's play the role of some external system, something like that, some external clock, then you get into contradiction and the theory doesn't make unique predictions. So it's actually, even just by saying that lambda could correspond to an external physical device and the readings of it, that gives you problems here. So that, in fact, the theory will predict uniquely where a particle is, where your weird clock is showing something specific, but that's because we have this differentiation about it. So it's actually less than a field where just a weird clock.
Okay. Are you going to speak about this later?
No, no,
this,
no.
This one, okay.
Yeah.
Then you can give me
some. I mean, there's a lot of subtle issues.
Well,
maybe it'll become more clear in the end. Let me just. So what I want to do is I want to motivate this from a different perspective. I want to motivate this theory. Because the way I want to motivate it originally seemed very hand wavy, and it was a general metric configuration space. And the reason is because ultimately I want to go to general relativity where you have a more general type of situation. But we can derive this theory from a much more hands on sort of way. So, and the way to do that is using something called the Ruthian procedure. And actually, Hans went through this calculation yesterday, but I'll go through it again because it's a little bit interesting. It's sort of a proof that there's a deep connection between this theory and this theory over here, which we wrote down. Okay, and the action for this theory, the parameterized particle mechanics. So this is just Newtonian mechanics made for parameterization invariant. Look like d lambda. And a t divided by q naught dot minus v times q. Okay. So this is the theory that we had before, and what you notice is that q naught enters the action only through its derivative with respect to lambda. Okay. So the action doesn't depend on the q naught directly. And whenever that happens, it's sort of a generic feature of theories like this. You have a conserved quantity. And in this case, that conserved quantity is the energy. And what you can do is then you can use that conserved quantity to sort of eliminate this variable from the action. It's like a superfluous variable. You have a conserved quantity means you have a symmetry. And so you can eliminate that symmetry using this Ruthian procedure that was sort of 150 years old or something. Okay. So, I'm not really going to motivate the procedure very much, but I will just sort of tell you what the algorithm is. So the algorithm is to take the algorithm is to take your conserved quantity, which again we worked this out last week, was minus t over q dot dot squared plus v, the conserved quantity was minus e, but in any case, we found that e was related to this way, and we use this equation, this possible equation, to solve for the Q dot dot, and then substitute that back into this action, right? So if we solve for the Q dot dot, in terms of E, we just have the equation before T over E minus V square root. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this, plug it back into here, but then we have to do something else. We have to add a term to the action that looks like just E times this guy. Right. And that's just the algorithm.
Why did you add another term to the action?
Sort of reason? So, well, yeah, I mean, basically, if you think of it from, I'll show you what the term looks like. So the you start with this theory, and then you now apply this new procedure, and it gives you a new theory, which I'm not going to give a name to yet. And it will look like this guy, T over Q naught dot minus Q naught dot times V. And then we add this extra term, E times Q naught dot. And then we evaluated this at Q naught dot equals T over E minus V. Now, the motivation for this guy, you can kind of think of it this way, is that if you're thinking of this as a Kaplan group or something, then this term is going to look like a delta function on E. So it's selecting a particular energy in your theory. And it's just saying that we're going to basically get rid of it's like doing a Fourier transform, right? It's like taking, here we're in the Q naught dot space, now we're going to move over to the E space and select out only one mode. So I don't really know how good of a motivation that was, but because that's
also in the totally mechanics, right? If you have the rotational symmetry, if you do this roving procedure, you get to an action which is contains. Well, so you start with an action with r and theta, but your potential is independent of theta, and your action only depends on theta dot. That's the only thing that comes into it. Then there's angular momentum is conserved. You go through this procedure. You can get an action just in terms of r dot and r, but with an effective potential.
Yeah. So basically, what this term is doing is it's acting as an effective potential. And it's hard for me to motivate it physically. I was actually thinking about this before the lecture. What is this term physically doing? I have some intuition because I've been working on path integrals with this thing for a while. But basically what it's doing is it's introducing an effective potential. It's sort of keeping you on a particular energy orbit.
So what would go wrong if you didn't add this?
What would go wrong?
Because you would still have E on there, right?
So the only thing is that would be...
So what you want to make sure is that the new action you get has the same predictions. From Newtonian mechanics with R and theta. You're going to have solutions, R of T and theta of T. And then, if you now want a new action, just in terms of R dot of R, you would make sure that your R of T is the same as in the original theory.
Mm-hmm.
So then you need to add this extra term.
Yeah.
And I think Sean is basically right. It's something to do.
It's not very well physically motivated, but if you just look at the mathematics, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but you go through the mathematics and you realize that in order to get the same predictions, the same equations, classical equations of motion, you need to put this term. So it changes the quantum theory drastically, actually, which is what we're going to see in a second. But classically, it's the same theory.
Good question, Lewis. So in the comparison made by Hans, so if you rewrite eliminating theta,
yeah,
it's because you need to take into account basically the centrifugal force.
That's right.
So it's telling you that there is something outside.
That's right. Yeah.
So here you have something outside which works as time.
Which is the energy, yeah.
Which is the energy.
Which is working as time. Exactly. No, that's a very important point to come back to that. This E is playing kind of like the role of time in this new theory. But it's a different physical concept. And so that's a really important point. So so this thing, okay, if we just plug in values, it's fairly straightforward to do. We have a lambda, now we have a T over E minus V square root minus T over E minus V times b plus e times t over e minus b. So what you see is this term is the square root of t times the square root of e minus b. And these terms together are the same term. So it actually gives us twice two copies of the square root of t times e minus b, which is this action. So you can see right away that what this, I mean, if you believe the motivation I told you, this new theory, which is the Jacobi theory, which was inspired by this more general considerations, is actually just Newtonian mechanics constrained to a particular energy. So that's the routine procedure. Now, it turns out that in a couple of lectures, probably in the next lecture, I'll start talking about a way to implement spatial relations. And you'll see that it's a lot different than this way that Barber came up with, Julian came up with for making a theory enforcing temporal relations among the theory. But this Ruthenian procedure turns out to be kind of deeply linked. So the way to get spatial relationalism is you call it best matching. And so if you apply best matching to this theory and this variable here, it's very, very similar to the Ruthenian procedure, but it's more general. It can deal with more general types of symmetries. And also, it works off-shell. See, this is something that's very constrained to be, when you're using the classical approaches, the motion, you're seeing the back of the action. So the best matching is a slightly, I think, more general procedure than this. And that's something that I talked about in my archive. I noticed this. So anyways, that's... The spatial relationalism and the temporal relationalism look very different, but actually they're intimately related. So now I'm just going to try to talk about the quantization of the state. But before I do, I need to write down the Hamiltonian and the Wilson. So now we're getting to the fun part, hopefully. Where we'll start to see interesting things happening. So, Hamiltonian formulation. So, what do we want to do? Well, the first thing is to define momentum. So, right now we only have one. Where's the field? We only have one type of configuration to zero, the particle positions. So the momentum conjugate to those guys are going to look like the derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the dots. Now, this is di Q dot dot of this guy. So 2 times square root of a half sum over I and I dot square times E minus B this. The only dependence of the Q dots is in the kinetic term. So we can just take the derivatives. And this guy moves downstairs, you get a factor of a half that cancels this 2. Which is actually the reason why we had the 2 there in the first place. Because now the momentum look familiar. This is going to be E minus B over T square rooted times M I Q I dot. Okay. So it looks a lot like the momentum that we're used to. This piece anyways. This piece is new, but if you remember from the theory we did last time, E minus V over T was equal to Q naught dot. So this thing is kind of playing the role of the derivative of the time. the Newtonian time. Okay. Now, if you look more closely at this expression, you see that, for the moment, just imagine that all the maps are the same. And what we have is we have Q dot II over sort of the sum of these guys dot squared. Right? So this looks, times square root. Right, so this looks like a vector divided by the length of the vector.
Yes, so it's just a Q dot dot sum as well.
What did I write it?
T over.
Well, yeah, sorry. Yeah. So here, this looks like the direction of a vector, right? This is a cosine of some angle. It's the norm has been taken out of this vector, and so Julian, I think, was probably the first person to realize that these momenta are directions. The norm here doesn't matter. And this is the thing that's giving us a gauge theory, as I was talking about yesterday. The fact that the norm doesn't matter, you have a many-to-one map between the Q dots and the P's. There are many Q dots that correspond to the same momentum. So momentum is just the direction, right? It has nothing to do with the magnitude. So so that we expect that we're going to have constraints. And sure enough, the fact that these guys are cosines makes us think that the momentum probably satisfy a circle item. And that's exactly what we get. So the circle item is what does the circle item look like? It looks like this. The sum over P I square plus B minus B equals 0. So this is the circle item that these directions obey, these cosines obey. And in fact, it's very similar to the constraint that we had last time, except that here we had P naught, which was a momentum conjugate to Q naught. But now we have something that we can see anymore. Now we have E, which is just a constant. It plays the role of a parameter. You might see where this is going. If we try to quantize this, both these dynamic operators, now we're going to have a time independent Schrodinger equation because E is just a constant. It's not an operator, it's not going to become an operator. So that's why you have the problem of time in this theory, not in anything. Well, mathematically, at least, that's how it comes. Now, we can check this. This is actually true. That's straightforward. We can use these definitions. This definition here. So we've got a square, which is B minus B over T, times the sum over I of. Now we're going to get two factors of M and two factors of this guy. But there's an M downstairs, so it leaves us with one guy left over two. Times the QI dots squared plus B minus E. This thing is just T. So the T, this T cancels this T. Yeah, sure enough. Should be already wrong. Well, sure enough, this is zero. Okay? So that's zero. Something, there's another quantity that's equal to zero. The canonical Hamiltonian. So to figure out what the Hamiltonian is, we do a Legendre transform, which means that we write, we take all the momenta, and we inner product then will be Q dots, and then we subtract the ground. But one thing that we can do is actually, we can just use these definitions and plug in the P's and then use the original action, which is going to be in terms of the, just in terms of the Q dots. And what we'll find is that it's zero. It's a zero. So if we use the definitions, we've got factor of E minus V over root T. Then we have sum over I of MI times Q dot I squared. Then our action is minus 2 root T B minus V. But what you can see is this thing is just twice the kinetic energy, right? So this T cancels on the root T down here, and we've got, what we have left is 2 root T times E minus B minus 2 root T times E minus B. So this thing is zero, okay? So this guarantees the quantum Hamiltonian. Even though we can't find the P's, a one-to-one map between the P's and the Q dots, we know, just based on these definitions, that this quantum Hamiltonian is going to be equal to zero. And that's exactly what we expected, because this theory is reparameterization invariant. I can redefine lambda, and we get the same theory. Okay. Great. So now, I'm starting to run out of time. What if I'm total Hamiltonian? So we know that it's just the Kronecker Hamiltonian plus a Lagrange multiplier, which is in general a function of, on phase space, times this constraint here. Now this guy is zero, we just showed that. So this guy is n times sum over I pi squared. I'm writing it again because what is this constraint? Plus b minus b. Because I want to work out the equations of motion. Right? So this is kind of the boring part where I get through the mathematics, but the reason why, and I like going through these equations, so that you believe me that it's true, that I say it's true. But also, because hopefully it gives you time to digest what's physically happening here. And I'll talk about what I think is physically happening in a second. Okay, so just very quickly, I'm going to write down the Poisson brackets. Well, we have the fundamental Poisson brackets. These are J's. And we can use these guys to figure out the equations of motion. Now, there's only one constraint in this problem. So it commutes with itself. It's a first-class constraint. It will generate gauge transformations. Those gauge transformations can kind of be thought of as the reparameterizations of the trajectories. So the point is that there's no more extra constraints. There's going to be no secondary constraints in the system. So this is the action. Now we can use it to find our equations of motion. So this is kind of interesting here. We've got Q dot so what we're looking for is we're looking for P's, right? Because the Poisson bracket with P's is equal to 1. So we're looking for P's up here. And, well, there's P's right here. And it's just like taking the derivative, those of you who are not familiar with some brackets. The derivative of this with respect to Q is just looks like P pi I over mi. Okay. So what we have is something, again, very similar to what we have in just normal particle mechanics, but now with this vector n, which is an arbitrary Lagrange multiplier. And we interpret that n as a gauge, time gauge. Remember, because in the definitions we have this thing, which is really we'll see that coming back in a second. So now when we take our p dot, try to find a p dot, that is going to be equal. Well, we're looking for the q's, and the potential is the only thing here that depends on the q's. So we've got a minus sign because now the p is over here. Times n. So now if we just rewrite this as is equal to mi, then we can take this lambda derivative. Right? And we can use these two equations to get the equations of motion in second order form. Right? So we use this guy. What we find is that if I have 1 over n times d by d lambda of 1 over n times mi qi dot, so this is a d by d lambda as well. Okay? That's equal to minus sine v. The m's are constants, so they come right out. And we see that you have something that looks very suggestive, right? You have this derivative that looks like 1 over this. And you have it twice. So wouldn't it be nice if that thing was the time? Okay. Is that one on my screen right now? I don't want to say it just yet, but this thing is the thing that we're going to define as d by t, and this is so that's a preview of in 2 seconds I'm going to say this. That's where we're going. That's sort of the image that I want to have. But now, what is this n? Okay, we can figure out what n is because we know that now we can apply the constraints. Right, so we're at the level of the classical equations of motion. So we know the constraint is going to be equal to 0. It's going to be satisfied. So what we can do is we can use the constraint to find the solve for n, right? In terms of the variables that we have, the gauge-independent variables. So remember that Hamiltonian, what does the Hamiltonian constraint look like? It looks like this. So now if I use this equation of motion, I can plug it. Sorry, but this is the way I can rewrite, I can plug this guy into here, and what I find is I have the sum over I of mi over 2 squared, right? But then I can pull out a factor of this n squared, because it doesn't depend on the I index. And then I have plus b minus e equals 0. This thing is the kinetic energy. So that means that n is t over e minus v squared root. So we can really put these equations of motion into a proper second order form by plugging this into this guy. Right? And we've got e minus v over t squared root times d by d lambda. There's a factor of mi over here. E minus v over t squared root. D by D lambda. Okay. And that's Newtonian mechanics, but it's Newtonian mechanics with this really funny factor here. And so that thing we're just going to call the Newtonian time. We're just going to call that, the derivative of the Newtonian type. So we're going to say definition d tau humerus, a free humerus time, is equal to b minus t over e minus b times d lambda. Now this thing, I wrote in with the lambda, but the lambda is not actually there, because inside the t we have two factors of lambda in the denominator, and those will cancel this guy. So really I can write this independent of lambda. I can write it just in terms of the differentials of q. And what it is physically is it's the length of this curve in configuration space. It's related to the length of this curve. So effectively what it's telling you is that the time that is elapsed, so the thing that we call Newtonian time, you can think of as the length of this curve in configuration space. It's the sum of all the differences of the configurations of the universe between one instant and another instant. And it's weighted by, some factors out in front. But aside from that, that's what you have. You have a measure of the change of the configurations of the universe. And that's the thing that you're going to call the ephemeris time. The reason why Julian likes to use the word ephemeris is because that's how astronomers measure time forever, by the changes of the planets or relative to the fixed stars. Right? So this is the claim here, that really what we have in classical Newtonian theory is the theory looks like this. But we interpret this quantity always as the ephemeris time. Now it just so happens that it's the same definition as this guy. So now what's the difference, right? I think that's the key point. This is where I'm going to end today. What is the key difference between this, the definition of time in this theory, and the definition of time in this theory, right? Now, you hinted at that a lot earlier in the talk, which was that, the role that energy plays in this theory is very different from the role that energy plays in this theory. In this theory, we fixed boundary conditions. So we said, this is a certain amount of time that's elapsed between this point and this point. And then we pick an energy that makes it so that that works. So that's what determines the energy. Here, the energy is a parameter of the theory now. So now energy is like a constant of the universe. And whatever that energy value is will tell us how much time has elapsed. Okay? Because if I change the energy, what it does is it effectively changes the metric on this configuration space. So it will change the length of this curve.
But it's always a constant.
So that's the idea. In this theory, it's a constant of nature that in principle could be measured. Right? And then the universe tells us. So that's the difference, is that here we sort of specify this is how much time has elapsed. Whereas here, the energy plays the role of a parameter of nature. And then that's the difference, is that even though all we've really done is just swap the role of E and T mathematically, that's effectively what we've done. We've done some sort of Fourier transform, kind of. So even though that's all we've done, physically we really changed the meaning of what's going on.
So is E in both cases a constant, or can E be in the second case a field which is dependent on the configuration variables?
It's not a field. It's a constant.
It's a constant. Right? Yeah.
But in a way, it's a strange constant, because in a way it's fixed by the boundary conditions. Right?
It's like the calibration, the definition of the unit length of the unit time.
Yeah, that's right.
But you fix that once
and
for all.
That's right. Yeah. You can think of it as a calibration of the unit time. Yeah. You can think of it as a way of determining what it's fixed in the universe.
And that is the only generalization from the Newtonian particle mechanics,
yes,
and parameter invariant formulation, and the Baader-Bertotti.
Yes,
components.
That's right.
You just leave the unit time interval unspecified.
That's right. You leave it unspecified. And then the thing that we really want is we want a principle that determines what E is, right? Because this theory tells us nothing about what E is. It still has to be measured or something in some way. It needs to be determined empirically, or it needs to be specified or postulated or something. But if we had a principle that would say E equals 0 or something, then that would be a very useful thing, because now we're not putting anything in by hand. And I think that if you really want a theory with true relational time, it needs to have some sort of principle for this. And Julian has some ideas about that. I'll talk about it. We'll see that later, like ideas about what this principle could be. So I have some ideas, Julian has ideas.
It's one of the you have to agree from the start, the particular form of kinetic energy. Now that form of kinetic energy is strictly related to Galilean invariance. And Galilean invariance is strictly related to a particular choice of external time. So it feels like somehow you have to drag in external time hidden.
Well, I kind of see your point. I mean, because we're taking our definition of this G prime, this metric, was, how do we define that metric? So maybe it is that in that definition we sort of set something up. But I don't really see, I can see how you might think that, but I'm not really sure if that's actually what's happening, right? Because in our definitions here, we're not putting in T anywhere.
The
kinetic energy, but there's no information about time anywhere.
This particular form, like it is quadratic in a constant the mass and so on.
Yeah.
So you derive it from Galilean invariance.
No, it's not like that. The theory is in fact not Galilean.
Yeah, exactly. Right. This theory is not going to be Galilean invariance if you boost or plot.
It's easy to see because the total energy is fixed, but if you would boost the whole system, you would change the total energy, but you're restricted to have one specific energy. So from one point of view, this is not a very satisfactory theory. This is not Galilean invariant for the whole universe. It would be so probably for subsystems.
Yeah. Well, approximately.
You might actually expect of a part of the Galilean invariant.
So what happens is the following. The whole universe has to have a certain energy. And now if you boost it, go to this reference, right? Then you're going to increase that energy, right?
But
unless you decrease the relative motions and so on.
But how can you boost the whole universe? I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Well, mathematically it makes sense.
No, because there's some reference point.
I think that these issues are going to come back.
Right.
Basically, the idea is you have to, even in the other cases, you're starting with an action. You have to start with something, right? And I think that this is a fairly minimal set of assumptions, but it's important. I mean, that's why I spent time on this blackboard, right? What are the assumptions of this theory? Well, we have an action, and it has a particular symmetry. It has a time translational invariance, basically, in a certain way. It's not as obvious as the other ones. When we use spatial relationalism, it'll be obvious that there's rotational invariance in this trajectory. At least a couple of potentials, and other invariances. And then it's sort of like, okay, now we're going to get rid of those symmetries, we're going to modify those symmetries. So what we try to do is we try to start with a theory that has this time translational invariance, and we try to get rid of that symmetry. Right? And what we're left with is this concept of energy. So we get this conserved quantity, this parameter at the end, and that's going to come back again. When we do rotations, we're going to try to get rid of the rotations. That symmetry, what we're going to left with is we're going to left with a principle that tells you something about another constant, which is the angular momentum. So the angular momentum is going to be playing a similar role to what the energy plays here. And then we're going to have a principle that's going to say the angular momentum is equal to 0. So it's sort of like you have this symmetry and you have a equivalence classes of things. And what you're doing is you're making a choice. You're making a choice for a particular, like a section in a fiber bundle or something. You're picking a preferred section. And that's kind of what this theory of time is also doing. So in that sense, I see what you mean, like, it's like, okay, there's a symmetry there, but we're trying to get rid of that. The whole point is we're trying to get rid of that symmetry that's built into the kinetic energy term, kind of. Yeah. But I think it'll become more obvious when we talk about other things. That's all I have to say about this. So if there's any questions now, you can ask, but it's, to me, like this thing is different from this thing in the sense that this thing, yes, is really telling you, giving you a measure of how much things are changing, and that is equivalent to the Newtonian definition of a click of a clock, and it's perfectly general, right? Now the clock is the entire universe, right? So it's a really nice definition of time, I think, in a lot of ways, and And maybe I actually printed these guys up because I realized that these are quotes I showed last week. And one of them was Mach's like second principle, which was temporal relationalism. The other one was his first principle, which was spatial relationalism. And so I felt like I should come back to these as the course goes on to say, okay, this is how these principles are implementing all of Mach's ideas. So maybe I begin to have them. So I'm not going to make any big philosophical statements, but I just, maybe if you read that first quote and try to figure out, like, oh, you have that or you don't want it? Oh, you wrote it down. So that was the thing. Is that, I mean, he says, it is utterly beyond our power to measure the changes of things by time. Quite the contrary, time is an abstraction at which we arrive by means of the changes of things, made because we are not restricted by any one definite measure, all being interconnected. So this is, I think what Julian means, is that this is our measure, is time as a measure of the changes of things. And it involves all the particles in the universe, so there's no sort of preferred way of doing it. There's no preferred clock in this definition. But again, there is an issue of this role in the place, which I think is maybe some quantity. Okay, so that's all. Next week I'm going to quantize this, but I already kind of did it, so. So that's it, yeah, thanks.